Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We wrapped up on natural law. And, you know, one of the things that really kind of helps me, and it may help you, is when you start looking at particular behavior, and this goes to an old model I learned a long time ago, does this behavior that you're doing meet your needs over time? In other words, is it going to sustain your life or is it going to shorten your life? Is it going to help you improve your life circumstances, and those types of things, such as education over going and playing golf, making sure that your priorities are aligned in your interest. And that's the same thing with society, with natural law, that it's not beneficial for society to promote or to even put out, the advertising, or actually I would say the enabling. And this is where the school system, this is a complete indictment regarding our education system, because it enables young children to embellish themselves in behavior that is contrary to what is good for them and what's good for society. And so understanding natural law and understanding how the framers thought and how they were operating in America. I mean, they created laws in some respects that took away liberty, but it was to a point where they felt that as enough people all agreed, then they were, it was okay to do that. It wasn't considered oppressive if there were a couple of people that were, let's just say, atheists, if, how few there was back in their day. But there were some. As I pointed out to somebody just recently, if you didn't know, if you were an atheist, you had no case or you had no right to court. In other words, you couldn't pursue a lawsuit against somebody in any of the courts in America, at least all of the courts that I know of. There could be an outlier here or there, but for the most part, even Thomas Jefferson was banished, or I shouldn't say banished, he was not allowed to bear testimony in his own behalf when he was going through a hearing on whether he should stand as charges of abandoning his post as governor. What ended up happening is that when the day he was supposed to be relieved as governor, he was being chased through the woods by Benedict Arnold and the British forces that was kind of rampaging through that part of Virginia at the time. And the governor that was replacing him did not like Thomas Jefferson. And there were a lot of people that did not like him of his time because this is their paradigm. He was not a Christian in good standing. So what does that mean? That means that Thomas Jefferson wasn't going to church regularly. He wasn't a regular face in the pews of the local church. And so anyway, when he was being tried, because this governor charged him with abandoning his post. So a traveling judge came down, and that traveling judge basically pulled the court together after he was already briefed with the facts. And who knows, it may have been the sheriff that told the traveling circuit judge that came in to hear the case that Thomas Jefferson's not a Christian in good standing. So before the case started, he pulled all the officers, Thomas Jefferson being one of them, up to the bench and said, "Mr. Jefferson, I understand that you're an officer of the court, so I will allow you to ask questions and cross-examine. However, I will not allow you to bear testimony and or opinions in this court, because you are not a Christian in good standing. Is that understood?" And that's how he laid it down. Alexis de Tocqueville, 50 plus years later, 50 plus years, because this was in the 70s, I believe, or early 80s, and it was definitely in the 1930s when Alexis de Tocqueville was traveling through America. And while he stopped, he highlighted this because he was just absolutely amazed that in an American court, a judge could throw out a case because the plaintiff claimed to be atheist. And the judge basically stated that if you can't attest and swear to a higher authority than you, to the Almighty God, our Creator, then your testimony and what you have to say has no credit, has no veracity. We can't believe you, in other words. And so that was how the framers had actually functioned and operated. So I know a lot of people would love to get back to something like that. But over time, we did become more tolerant. Tolerant like Christ, I would say. But we were probably stupid in many ways, unlike Christ, because we started enabling bad behavior. And we look at today. I mean, it's society allows and embraces, and as a matter of fact, you better tolerate it and you better support it, or they will come after you and destroy your life, especially if you're anybody of importance. So the only reason I know that I haven't reached that level of importance is because I'm not under that direct attack as of yet. But the day will come when people will be listening to every one of my shows so that they can find things to complain about and to, you know, hoist me up on the gallows. Anyway, what we need to do is we need to remind you that this show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, and this is only the only show that gives you the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions. We have a comment line, 425-270-5416. You can call 24/7. You will not wake me. It's a line that we've set up to basically record any question or comment you may have. And so we would ask that you just put it out there, try to be concise, but if it really merits a lengthy dialogue, we'll call you up and we'll actually have that conversation. We'll record it so that we can play it. I go out of my way to try to make sure that those people who have something to say, whether that be in emails, a lot of times if you email me, I just don't necessarily convey that in my show. But when you do make a call and you put it out there, then okay, there we go. We're going to give you the recognition. We're going to play your question, and we are going to answer that. So anyway, we've set that up so that you're not dictated to the one-hour time slot to try to get a hold of me. And so where we are is we really, like I said, we wrapped up natural law, and we're heading into American republicanism. And the importance of this portion of setting the stage for the Constitutional Convention and then the ratification of the Constitution was because during the Constitutional Convention, there was this contention. As you know, Virginia and Madison created this plan, briefed it to the Virginians, Governor Morris and so forth, and they basically said, okay, this is going to be our plan we're going to present. And so there was the Virginia plan and the New Jersey plan. And in response to both of those plans, the Connecticut plan came out. Prior to the Constitutional Convention, republicanism was really based on representation of people. In Parliament, Parliament has two houses. It's got the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And the House of Commons is the representatives of the common people. The House of Lords is an aristocracy where they appoint who they want to represent them and do their bidding. Kind of like similar to the legislatures, but it's still a representation of people, not a different level of sovereignty. Like in America, see, we were creating these separate sovereign states, which was never fathomed before, to create a single government. Well, actually, the Roman Empire. But the Roman Empire never recognized and gave sovereignty, independent sovereignty, to each of its states. It became the boss, and you did what you were told. So anyway, as we kind of look at republicanism, republicanism by definition means two things. It means representation, and it means that we have a legal system or rule of law that instead of having a magistrate or a single sovereign dictate by his by their whims, could be her, but they can dictate by their whims what you can do today and what you can't do today. And a Republican form of government is one that is representative, and it is also one that has established laws that delegate very specific powers and or general powers, but regardless, it has these laws. And so in a monarchy, it's not a republican form of government. Now, Britain had kind of a hybrid because they had a monarchy with some representation, and there was claim, and they go through this in the debates, that there was claim that Parliament had, you know, this level of sovereignty, but the reality is the king could pull back sovereignty whenever he wanted or whenever they wanted, the monarch could. Anyway, we're going to be going into, or we'll be wrapping up this either in the next segment or so, but we will be getting into the debate. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. And so when we dive into the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, now there's lots of these C's, cons, and so forth, and so I may get tongue twisted, so forgive me. But when we start looking at the presentation of plan, you gotta understand that 9 times out of 10 when people, you know, have a paradigm, when they migrate to something new, like all indications probably would have been to everybody in Europe that as the colonies broke away, the colonies were either going to create their own kings or create a king kind of similar to the King of Britain, that they would have a monarchy, because that's from whence they came, right? I mean, look at how long the people of the British Isles had had kings. And so it was in their blood, so to speak. But they were so, so upset and so convinced how the monarchies were wrong, even though there were some people that would claim, and I believe it was Hamilton that claimed that a noble monarch is probably the greatest form of government, because then the monarch is actually serving the people instead of serving themselves. But you have no control over that, and nine times out of ten, they're not that noble. Anyway, so to look at what they were going to do and how they moved from this Articles of Confederation, which was literally just a legislative government. There was no executive. There was no judiciary, really. I think the legislative body, the Continental Congress, was the driving factor. I mean, it was kind of like the fact was, it was a headless horse because it was capable of doing work, but it couldn't make any decisions, and it had really no power to do anything. So, thus the need for the Constitutional Convention. And so, one of the things that occurred as they were ramping up to the Revolution, but prior to the Declaration of Independence, the big question was, what kind of government were we going to have? And John Adams put his name into, you know, notoriety, and, you know, went into the annals of history on a paper he wrote, It Must Be a Republic, or something to that effect, that basically identified that we have to create a republic form of government here, and that we, you know, and here's the reasons why. And there were a lot of other people that were kind of agreeing, and that was all in word space, but he was the first to really commit a lot of cognitive properties, and it was an academic argument. You got to remember, he was a lawyer, and the thing that really made him infamous was the fact that he happened to be the guy that defended the four British soldiers that, you know, the Boston Massacre, and got them off. So, I mean, there were a lot of Americans that weren't too happy that he did a good job. So anyway, John Adams kind of put, I think, a real marker out there that everybody, you know, was saying, yeah, it's got to be a republic form of government. Because remember, I always say, reasonable people equally informed seldom disagree. The problem's that middle part. Well, the advantage in their day was that middle part, because they were all equally informed. They didn't have the internet. They didn't have a variety of different books that were popping up from all different parts of the world and the country, that, you know, there was very limited books. As a matter of fact, when Thomas Jefferson was in France, he was buying books and sending them by the caseload to James Madison, who would then pick them up, read them before he took them to Monticello and put them into Thomas Jefferson's library. And so Madison, by far, was probably the most literate person in America, just because of his exposure that was active in politics, because Jefferson was buying these books and didn't have the time to actually sit down and read them. But Madison, at this point in time, because he was so young and, you know, he wasn't really working as a congressman or anything else. I mean, he was getting involved in the state. It was his exposure to all of these books that helped him become a very, very, what do you want to call it, a formidable adversary for people that wanted to oppose his ideas. And so one of the things that was stated about James Madison was he was the most prepared at any debate. That when he took the stand, he usually had a, you know, satchel or, you know, a box of books or, you know, in tow, a lot of reference material just in case he needed to pull something out. Anyway, so as they were going into the Constitutional Convention, most people were going, okay, we've got a republic, we've got this legislative branch, it's not working, we really need to have you know, more power. There was a lot of rumor, and everybody, you know, there was more of rumor in a bad way that there was going to be a monarch. But the interesting thing was that the one monarch that America would have swallowed would have been George Washington. And as a matter of fact, I believe the sentiments in Europe was the fact that George Washington, because of his infamy, was going to be one of those, maybe I hope I didn't get that wrong, because of his notoriety, because he was famous in America. Infamy, I think, is a bad thing. Anyway, forgive me. So George Washington was probably the hands-down favorite that they thought would become a monarch. And so you got to understand, the prudes of Europe looked at a military man as a monarch, as a limited man, that a monarch of nobility and of, because they, the concept in Europe was that your bloodlines meant far more than anything else, because of, that's how you got exposed. You got to remember that education back then was not nearly as, I'll just say, as diverse and as multifaceted as it was today, even though it was very multifaceted. And if you compared what they were learning to what kids learn today, night and day difference, because we learn about being indoctrinated, or that's what kids are learning, where they were actually learning the fundamentals of writing, cursive, and etiquette, and a lot of different things. But anyway, so going into this constitutional convention, there was the sentiments that, you know, that what was going to come out of this was going to be something very similar to what we had seen before. And that was the furthest thing from the truth. And there is no doubt. As a matter of fact, this is the one circumstance, this is the one case in American history, other than other points in time, where individuals like George Washington and or others, you know, talked about, you know, getting on their knees and praying, and the divine hand of providence intervening and or, you know, helping or inspiring. But this was the only time, because the convention that wrote up the Articles of Confederation, there was really no mention that they prayed together and they sought the divine hand of providence's inspiration. That only happened in the Constitutional Convention. And every single one of these men acknowledged the fact that they were definitely led by his spirit, by the inspirations of that divine hand. And so, putting that into perspective, when Madison laid out the model or his plan, the Virginia plan, and actually it wasn't Madison, it was Randolph, Governor Randolph, that laid it out. Madison was the one that was defending it, though. Even though everybody else could defend it, Madison was probably the one that, you know, when they couldn't answer the questions, he was the one that was able to give the details that they were seeking. But here's the interesting thing. It was rejected because what Madison's plan would have done, and if the fundamental basis that it was rejected for, was apportionment was to be throughout the government, and the power would be distributed by the number of citizens in every state. So your representation would be based on apportionment of the citizens, which would have given Virginia the hands-down favorite. They would have been the big dog. They would have been able to control the majority of the federal government, because they were almost half. I mean, I don't have the numbers, but they were so sizable that these other small states looked at them and said, no way, we won't have anything to do with it. And most of the states said, we're not going to have anything to do with it, because it was apropos. It was, you know, it was almost expected that the big state would come along and say, we believe that we should be governed by apportionment, and that the larger population states that have should have the largest representation. Well, of course, they want to defend their position. This is just like in states where you have cities that have a large population, and so they are capable, like Chicago, of destroying the state by running it into the ground, and they basically control state government. To be clear, that was not the intent of our Republican form of government. And as a matter of fact, the reason why they distributed the government out to the counties and out to the states and so forth on an equal voice was to ensure the population centers and or because they knew mob rule was the antithesis of a civil government in protecting the rights of the minorities. When I say minorities, I do not mean the demographic minorities. I mean the counties that are in a minority of population. They have disparate interests, and those interests needed to be protected, which is why they laid the design out the way they did. But anyway, I'm jumping ahead. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so during this constitutional, and actually, like I said, going into this convention, the understanding of a Republican form of government and republicanism was representation, and representation was the people. It was just a commonality that everybody understood, and it was the easiest thing to grasp that the people are the power of government, you know, the power in the people. The people have the power. I mean, you hear that even today. And so when I talk to anybody that the people have the power, then I say, well, that's actually not our government because that's not a representative government. Not that the people don't have the power within the representatives, but we're not the ones in power. We've delegated our power to our representatives. That's the whole point of a representative government. And so they understood this. As a matter of fact, they lived republicanism to a degree that they probably had little committees and conventions first thing in the morning as to what they were going to do for lunch. And then after lunch, they had a little convention. They all sent off their delegates to figure out who was going to, you know, what they were going to do for dinner or the evening entertainment or what have you. I mean, they lived by delegating power to, you know, somebody to go off, their secretaries or somebody else, to go off and figure out what they were going to do about lunch. Anyway, when they went in and they were being propose these concepts. The New Jersey plan was completely opposite. And as a matter of fact, it was just like the Articles of Confederation. And it was quickly dismissed because everybody said, well, this is why we're here to try to fix this problem. And so there was this complete stalemate. And it came down to, I don't know who it was, but I remember it was a delegate from Delaware that when they said, what's the problem? How come you guys won't, buy into this Virginia plan? And this delegate said, we don't trust you bigger states. And so with that, Roger Sherman was struck by inspiration, and he presented a plan that would create two sovereign bodies, the House of Representatives and the Senate. And in so doing, it had a balance. And what he did was he basically aligned, he started creating that, but they all recognized the brilliance of this by having a Senate that represented the sovereigns, because his position was that clearly the government is sovereign, and if we're creating a government that is for the people, then we would be bypassing the state government, or we would be treading on top of the state government by creating two governments that represent the people. However, and this was one of the reasons why they created an enumerated government instead of general powers, because most of the states, as Madison even pointed out, had general powers, and they didn't even have bills of rights. As they complained during the ratification debates, that, hey, where's the Bill of Rights? This Constitution is defunct and dead on arrival because it doesn't have this Bill of Rights. At least that was the primary argument of the Anti-Federalists. But looking at what Roger Sherman presented, he presented a plan that would put into the different houses of Congress the matters that would be more important to those sovereigns, such as cabinet positions, that would be more important to the state and state governments, the appointment of Supreme Court justices, more important, because at that point in time, there was no crime. As Jefferson pointed out, it was just treason, counterfeiting, high crimes on the seas, and or crimes committed against the laws of nations. I mean, the federal government had no power to punish or create any type of criminal crime that could actually start oppressing the people. That was all left to the states. So as we looked at this compromise and the way it started getting doling out, well, where does this power go? Where does this power go? It made it easier to identify, well, this is declaring war is not a state interest, that's an individual interest, because it's their family, their kids that are going to be called to war and possibly kill them and die. So they started allocating or aligning the powers under these two separate houses based on the fact that they were sovereign over different things. And in so doing, because bottom line, you're the sovereign of your home. The state government only has, the traffic laws and the basic stuff of commerce, your property tax. But when it comes to when you pray, how you worship, and those types of things, that was clearly, the freedom of the people. And the people had lots of freedoms. Well, today, we hardly have any freedoms because the state, or actually the federal government, is dictating so many things in our lives from, as I've stated before, toilet, how much water a toilet flushes, or, the ingredients of different products. The federal government has no constitutional power to do that, but the states could be doing that, and some states do that, but the bottom line is that the concept of a government to be able to start usurping those powers only happens if there are general powers granted. Enumerated powers makes it contractually illegal for a government to be able to assume powers. So in creating this enumerated power and delineating or aligning those powers to the two different sovereigns, it was absolutely brilliant. I am telling you, this was never done in any country, and every country that tried to duplicate this failed miserably because they didn't understand this fundamental basis of sovereignty and who should have the ultimate say between the representatives of the people and the representatives of the state governments underneath. And this is why the state governments, even today, have failed miserably with their bicameral legislative bodies in the same configuration, and even court justices have violated the Constitution from Reynolds v. Sims and others in ruling that counties don't deserve representation. Are you kidding me? So going into this Constitutional Convention, it was kind of who knows what, but what came out was, very odd. And when I say odd, I don't mean O-D-D, I mean A-W-E-D, odd, where people were just amazed at the type of government and its configuration. And as a matter of fact, even the anti-federalists, after the ratification debates, went into the seat of government. Almost every single one of them became huge fans of this federal government scheme. And when Madison tried to amend the Constitution, and one would think that New York and Virginia would be very quick to get on board with and want to amend the Constitution. But for some reason, these guys that were anti-U.S. Constitution, according to Patrick Henry, and the fact that these guys were anti-federalists, all of a sudden, they were no longer on board with trying to dismantle this. As a matter of fact, it was their position that let's kick the tires on this thing. Let's take it around the block a few times before we worry about amending it. And so this is where, we can start looking at American republicanism as a turning point. There were a lot of different epochs that came from this Constitutional Convention. And the configuration of government was one of those things, because every state in the Union went back into constitutional conventions and reconfigured their state government in creating bicameral legislative bodies that had representatives of the people and then representatives of the sub-element of government, which would have been the county or the parish or whatever that sub-element is in your state. And so with that, I think I kind of lay out this importance that we have to have in understanding American republicanism versus just basic republicanism. That there is, it's not just we the people, it's we the sovereigns, whether that be the states and or the people, and that there's two separate competing interests. And this is why you don't give two competing interests the same responsibility. I think it was Mr. Clay in Virginia that made a comment. He says, how can these two sovereigns, even coexist? Well, the fact is that because they were given different responsibilities, it helped them keep from getting into each other's knickers. Doesn't mean that they were, good to get along. As a matter of fact, there is still this concept that the Senate is more important than the House of Representatives. And I beg to differ. I think that they both have equal importance. And so, anyway, what we have is definitely one of those things that created a, several different epochs. And the amazing thing was after the first session, or during the first session, I think it was in August, after they were kind of wrapping up for the summer, they went to Washington and they said unanimously, I want to make a big point on this, that both houses unanimously requested and signed a request to George Washington to declare a day of Thanksgiving and fasting. And so our first Thanksgiving was not just an edict of the president. It was a unanimous call for the representatives of the people in the states to just show their thanks towards him, our creator. So this understanding of this divine hand of providence, and, well, I'll be right back. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. I cannot marginalize the magnitude of the gratitude of these framers, these men, and actually the nation. And as a matter of fact, the way I see it, when this constitutional convention was completed and the Constitution was signed, it was almost like the love of the Lord finally rested upon this nation. And as I tell people, this is my perspective. The Articles of Confederation was 13 articles. And what the Lord was capable of doing was he took those 13 articles and organized them and actually added more order, more civil order, more organizational order. And he was able to do that in 6 articles instead of 13. Now, it doesn't mean that the Constitution only had 6 articles. He did everything. He did all of the work in those 6 articles. And in the 7th article, he rested the power upon the states. He basically sanctified this by placing the power in the parties. Only the Lord knew that in doing this in a form of a compact, instead of a charter, instead of some other form of constitution by granting general powers, but by having the parties, the states, delegating very specific powers and only those powers, it reserved all powers outside of the central government. And only the Lord knew. Actually, the framers all knew this, but the Lord basically sanctified this thing, this constitution, in such a way that the states have all the power and authority to call out the general government for their violations. And we'll get into this with the 1798 resolutions. But I want you to understand that the spirit and the humility and the tone of the nation and these men, not just these men, but the men at the ratification debates and so forth, it's very humbling to see how this nation was really formed and blessed to move forward. So with that, as they started going out to the ratification debates, the Federalist Papers, or I should say, not the Federalist Papers, but the Anti-Federalists, those who were against the Constitution, who would be against the Constitution? Well, it was the powers, the operating powers in the states, because the powers in the states felt like they were losing some of their power. Technically, they didn't lose much of their power other than the fact that the federal government was going to be able to direct tax and, you know, be able to, with, you know, draw some of their resources that they, you know, they wanted to have a monopoly on. Well, for you to create the level of union and for you to create the symbiosis and the synergy between these independent and disparate states, you have to, you know, put, you know, what do you want to do, skin in the game. You have to put some money on the table. You actually have to get vested into this. And so this was, you know, like I said, this has never been done. This form of government was never done before. And still to this day, it's not. Even the United Nations is a quagmire. It's a little, you know, vestiges and a pot of corruption and power mongers and so forth. It is an embarrassment. It has no business being on American soil. We have the copyright on global governance, and the U.S. Constitution is the only document that we should trust as a as a document for global governance. Anyway, going forward, as I was trying to say going into the break, that none of these men ever recanted their position that they were inspired. All of these men considered themselves blessed. And as a matter of fact, in so many different ways, they were blessed. But they weren't necessarily blessed with riches or anything else. But they were blessed with tranquility, the plagues and those types of things. Even though some of those was still kind of continuing, it became a backseat and it became, I'd just say, second nature in just kind of dealing with that as they started improving and how they dealt with that. But going into the ratification base, the Anti-Federalists, they all picked the primary weak point, that this document did not have a Bill of Rights. Now, one of the things, just to prove those who believe that this was a runaway convention, if you look at the Federalist Papers, one of the things that they tried to call out was that this was a runaway convention. And Madison, in I believe Federalist Paper 39, 40, 41, if you read through that, he's talking about how they actually used the Articles of Confederation almost verbatim in some parts of the Constitution. They did everything they could and everything they were chartered to do, or everything that they were, you know, commissioned to do by the committee. And so he took an insult to this concept that they were a runaway convention. Well, it didn't have much legs. And the only state that really tried to stick to that one issue, because Patrick Henry really wanted to kill the Constitution. He did not want to see Virginia in its most powerful state, because it was the most powerful state at the time in the Union. He did not want to see it lose any power or to become second in the United States or in America to this new government. And he literally called this government a new government. So he did everything he could to protect Virginia's interests. And this is why the Federalists, or I should say the Anti-Federalists, were so adamant in trying to kill the Constitution. And so going into the ratification debates, there were some states that were getting organized. As a matter of fact, there was organization communication between New York, Virginia, the Carolinas, and so forth, because they started saying, okay, well, what are you guys saying? And is that working? And they were trying to share in trying to stop the ratification of this Constitution. And surprisingly, in some regards, it was closer than it should have been. Because due to the fact that every time they made an assertion, there was, as far as I'm concerned, very good clarity provided in the rebuttal by the Federalists as to what this Constitution was. So with that, we've kind of killed, or I should say, we've basically wrapped up American republicanism, and now we've created a recognition of two representatives in republicanism, the people and the sub-element of government. So at the state level, that sub-element of government is the county. And at the national level, that sub-element of government who has delegated powers for, you know, the people within that geographical region would be the states. And so as we, you know, move forward, we're going to find, you know, some really interesting debates. But again, this was a brand new concept, okay? Now, what we want to do, and how much time do I have? I only have 2 minutes. So I probably won't be able to get into this, but I do want to read just due to the fact that it's like, forgive the expression, but I don't know if you've ever heard of the term a brown noser, but it seemed like Delaware, being the first one to ratify on December 7th, they were just like, kissy, 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 we do this freely. And so we, the deputies of the people of this Delaware state in convention, met having taken into our serious consideration the federal constitution proposed and agreed upon by the deputies of the United States in a general convention held at the city of Philadelphia on the 17th day of September. In the year of our Lord, see, a lot of times those to say that, in the year of our Lord, I guess we're not Christian though. Anyway, 1787, have approved, assented to, ratified, and confirmed, and by these presents do in virtue of the power and authority to us given for that purpose, for and in behalf of ourselves and our constituents, freely, fully, and entirely approve of, assent to, ratify, and confirm the said Constitution. I mean, how redundant. All they had to do was say ratify. Yes, we accept this and the terms of this compact. Done in convention at Dover the 7th day of December in the year aforesaid and in the year of the independence of the United States of America, the 12th. In testimony whereof we have hereunto subscribed our names. Here's an interesting little fact about Delaware. It only had three counties at the time. And if you also look, that Delaware didn't have a governor, it had a president. And basically it was Thomas Collins, president of the Delaware state, do hereby certify that the above instrument. So what ended up happening was to not diminish the position of the president of the United States, the executives of the states became governors. I want you to understand, and this was really well understood, and they talked about this in the debates, that every state governor or executive is equal to the executives of France, of England, and so forth and so on, because they are independent sovereign states just like those states are. And therefore, we don't want to marginalize what a governor really is. However, executives only have the power to faithfully execute the laws that are made by the legislators. The legislators are the sovereigns. And with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.